Welcome, everyone. If you have interest in hearing how you live in one state and purchase investment real estate in a completely different market, you are going to want to hear what Matt Bacheny has to say. Matt went to school for theater and actually started his career for the first 5 years as an actor. He then goes on to start his own tech company, works in large media advertising, and then finds his way into real estate. This guy is an investor in over 4,000 units. On to the intro.
Welcome to Darren Batchelder's Real Estate Investing Show. Each week, you will learn how to grow your wealth through real estate investing. Be introduced to the players that are getting it done and learn how you can get involved. And now, here's your host, Darren Batchelder.
A little background on Matt Bacheny before we start the show. Matt lives in Boston. He had several career paths before getting into the real estate, including being an actor, starting his own company, working in large-scale media companies, managing very large projects. He is a people person. At the same time, he is a details-oriented guy with a couple real estate certificates from Boston University. He is an investor in over 4,000 units. He's purchased land. He's purchased single family. He's syndicated large-scale multifamily. He's even co-produced a couple Broadway plays. This guy has a heart for helping others, both through charities and through helping the newbie real estate investor. Now, on to the show. Hey, everyone. I've got Matt Bacheny with me here today. Matt, appreciate you coming on the show today.
Darren, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. This is audio only, but if you listeners could see Matt's office right now, you guys would be jealous. So I can look at him, but we're not recording the video, but he is outside in Boston and he's got the kids' swing set behind him and he is enjoying the outdoors in the Northeast. So Matt, really appreciate you coming on. Hey, just a little intro in terms of how Matt and I know each other. Matt and I met through a multifamily mentorship group that we're both a part of. And, you know, when he joined, he actually reached out to me through a private Facebook group. And we had a great long conversation over the phone. And then when he came into Dallas, you know, we had a networking event and we had some beers and got to hang out. And he's just a great guy and he's got a lot to share. One of the things that I'm excited for you to share, Matt, is you're located in Boston and you've actually purchased assets outside of your state. So that's one of the things that I definitely want you to be sharing with the group as we go forward. So with that, don't want to spend a ton of time on your background because I've already given a little bit of it, but how many properties and total number of units are you invested in?
Oh, at this point, I'm invested in, it's about to be over 4,000 units.
4,000?
Yeah. And so 75% of those I'm invested in as a passive investor. So, gotcha. Darren, you and I met each other a few years ago, as you mentioned, through a mentorship group. It's been really wonderful, actually, to see both of us continue to grow our careers and our portfolios over time. But a lot of through being in that group, I've been able to meet a lot of different people who are syndicating deals, and I've invested in a lot of them. But the other 25% of my portfolio are deals that I either own completely just, you know, by myself, or those are deals that I've syndicated myself and that I'm one of the sponsors or the lead sponsor on, and have many investors involved in those projects with me.
That's fantastic. So you said 25%, so about 1,000 units you've either purchased individually or syndicated?
Yeah, we're getting close to 1,000. A little awesome. Shy of that.
Awesome. So where do you live?
So I live in Boston, Massachusetts, and I own absolutely zero properties in the state of Massachusetts.
And why is that?
Well, the numbers just don't make sense here. You know, they don't. I've been looking. I had a 1031 exchange to do about a little over a year ago now, I guess. About 18 months ago, I did a 1031. And I had an opportunity with it's kind of a complicated story, but there was an air rights. I had some air rights that I was selling. And so instead of paying the taxes on it, it made more sense to do a 1031 exchange, which, as you know, is where I could move that money into another property. And therefore I wouldn't have to pay the capital gains because I'm reinvesting it right away. And so I was looking for something to do in Boston because this is the area that I live in and I would love something in my backyard. I mean, I looked up to about an hour away. By car at many different opportunities. And I just couldn't find anything that makes sense. I ended up buying a 6-unit in the middle of Kansas City. Well, because I know that area. I have other units, properties in that area. And there was something that came across my desk and the numbers made sense. They just don't make sense up here.
So I used to live in Connecticut and I'm familiar with that area. I was not in real estate at the time. But, you know, from living up there, you know, all growing up and I went to school, University of Rhode Island. So I'm familiar with it. I know it's really costly up there. Everything is expensive. So I can understand why you would want to look outside your market. And I want to get into that a little bit. But before we do, I don't know your background. Help me understand, you know, what were you into? What kind of business were you doing before you got into real estate, before we met?
Yeah, that's a long story. I could write a book about it, and I actually am. But I started off, I grew up in Florida, and I moved to New York City. And
where in Florida?
The Orlando area.
Okay.
I moved to New York City to pursue a career in theater. I went to a musical theater conservatory in Manhattan, graduated from that, and I was a professional actor for 5 Wow. years. Yeah. And then I moved from that. I started tinkering around with computers. This was in the mid-90s. And I ended up having an opportunity. I started doing some freelance work, and then I ended up growing that business out of my little one-bedroom apartment in Manhattan to the point where I couldn't fit any more desks in my little apartment and had to actually get an office space, and was running a boutique, digital marketing firm in New York for about 5 years. And then, we had the dot-com bubble burst, and then really the nail in the coffin for my company was the terrorist attacks of 9/11. And I had an opportunity for to go in house at a client of mine, which was Showtime, the cable television channel. And so I worked there for almost 5 years. And then I segued from there into working at these big, large, traditional advertising agencies in New York City. So I worked in advertising agencies for, I think, a little over 16 years.
Wow. Just,
yeah, working my way up the corporate ladder. I was a project manager, so making sure things got done on time, on budget, and at the highest quality possible. And I learned marketing basically through osmosis from being involved in all these big, high-profile projects. I ended up, sort of climbing that corporate ladder and, towards the end of my career, I was managing teams for very large projects, like teams of 100 people or more, working on massive endeavors for, Procter & Gamble and Verizon, Coca-Cola, a lot of these large corporate entities. And then what happened was, so during that time, as a hobby or as a side hustle, as the kids are calling it nowadays, I started doing real estate. I mean, it was something that was fun, that was interesting to me. It was a way to sort of diversify out of all the money I was putting into the stock market through my 401k. I just wanted to put money in something else other than just that. Right. I ended up getting married and we had a child, and my wife got an opportunity out of the blue. Really cool opportunity for her that would require us to move down to Miami, Florida. And I thought, well, I'm not a huge fan of Miami, but there are worse places we could go.
Yes, absolutely.
So we moved down to Florida, close to my parents who still lived in my hometown of Orlando. And that's when I transitioned from the corporate Madison Avenue world that I was in into doing the real estate full time. I had been doing it part time before.
Gotcha.
As a hobby, but this was the time I transitioned, and that was about 5 years ago now. And I said, okay. Yep, I'm going to go do this full time.
Fantastic. So that was, there's a lot there. You have an interesting
background. Yeah, that's why I'm writing a book about it.
we'll get to that. That's incredible. You're writing a book. So look, I know this is a real estate show, but I'm interested. Like,
sure.
So acting. Like, what'd you do? Like, were you on any TV shows, movies? What was your big claim to fame?
Yeah. Well, my biggest, widest, thing that anyone would have seen was when I was actually at 12 years old. I was, I worked at Disney World. And I was on television in the Easter parade. And then when I got a little older, when I was 16, I started working there full time. And I was Mowgli from the Jungle Book. So I still have a recording of it. My kids get a kick out of it, of me dressed as Mowgli, dancing around with a wig and a loincloth, doing cartwheels and front handsprings down Main Street USA at Walt Disney World. So
that's funny.
That's probably like the widest reaching audience thing that I did. I was in a number of student films. I was actually in a music video at one point that was on MTV.
MTV, really? Like, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, but I was covered from head to toe in red stocking like material. are you familiar with the artist Keith Haring?
No.
So I love Keith Haring. He's a great artist. He was a protege of Andy Warhol. Okay. And so Keith Haring was a big artist in New York City, in the 80s. And a lot of his stuff is now getting more and more into pop culture. I actually have a shirt of his that Uniqlo sells. They're selling, shirts with his artwork on it and stuff. Anyway, this was a song that was written about him, and he's known for these characters that he would draw. And this was like the director's interpretation of the characters. So you can't really see my face, although like if you know me, like you can see me kind of under this red stocking, like you can see my face kind of, right. But otherwise you wouldn't like recognize me. So I did mainly theater. I was mainly a stage actor. I did a lot of musical theater productions across the United States. I've, actually performed in every major city in the continental U.S.
Wow.
It was a lot of fun. I had a great time doing it. I don't miss doing it at all. I mean, it was a blast. I'm involved now in theater by helping sort of support different shows and things like that I feel strongly about. But I don't know if I'll ever be on the stage again, but it was a blast, man. I really, really loved doing it.
Look, there's acting. It's, you see people on TV and you just think they have overnight success, right? And like it's a hard grind to actually, build it up and make it. And to spend 5 years slugging away, both in theater and in other avenues, it just says a lot about you, and then from there you went and started your own company. Out of your apartment. And that's pretty awesome. Because I think that some of those things parallel into real estate, right? There's there's certain amount of risk in taking action that has to take place. You know, so there's a lot of people that are interested in real estate, and there's a lot of people that will actually take the next step and start reading about real estate or listening to podcasts. But actually, you know, stepping your foot out and taking a chance, and, you know, you have to have the ability to go into the unknown a little bit, you know, and you had to do that. And then starting your own company is a risk. And then, you know, you went and worked for some great companies. So you got to see how the big boys do it also. And you took all that experience and brought that to real estate. So that's pretty awesome. So tell me about the first deal that you did from out of state. Were you still living in Miami, or had you moved to Boston at this stage?
Well, so interestingly enough, the first investment real estate transaction that I did was an out-of-state transaction, and I'll explain why. I lived in New York City, and I owned the apartment I was living in. It was a co-op. I had already lived in one co-op first and then sold that and moved into, you know, upgraded to a little bit of a better location. And so I had done a couple of real estate transactions, and I was interested in doing more real estate. And it's kind of a long story, but I ended up with an opportunity to purchase some land in Connecticut, actually, in Northwest Connecticut. In Litchfield County. And
what town? Because I grew up in Brookfield.
Goshen.
Okay.
Yeah. So right, it's adjacent to Litchfield. And I ended up, it is a beautiful lakefront community. I knew, I don't want to get too much into the story, but a really good friend of mine, her father was a realtor, and he had shown me the property because I was building a website for him, and then like the area. And then I saw that he had some lots for sale. I ended up buying a vacant lot, and then I ended up actually building a house on there. And again, it's a whole very long, very interesting story, but that was the first thing that I ever purchased as an investment. And that was a 2-hour drive from my home in New York. This was in Connecticut, so out of state. And I learned a lot of lessons from that experience.
what kind of lessons did you learn?
Oh, I mean, I could just go on and on about it.
Give us like the top two or three. we don't have time for the book yet.
Well, yeah.
We do want to read the book when it comes out.
Yeah. But. Yeah. No, it's in there. I just learned building a house, right? So like I had never built a house before, and I bought a raw piece of land. And so just everything that you can imagine that's involved with drawing the plans and then seeing how everything's getting put together with the electrical systems and the plumbing systems and framing and roof and foundations and fixtures. And, you know, there's just so many different things that go into it that I think a lot of people, including myself at the time, just completely took for granted, right? I mean, I had already purchased two homes at that point. You know, I owned one and sold it and moved, right? But I never realized that they were already constructed. I never realized all the different planning aspects that were involved in it. You know, the other thing that I really learned was exactly what not to do if you're looking to generate. And the goal on this was not to generate income, right? The goal on this was I lived in Manhattan and I wanted to be able to get out of the concrete jungle from time to time and go escape, right?
It was more like a second home for you at first.
Initially, yes. So the thought was, you know, I bought this land. And I was like, oh, this will be a great investment, because I had made a killing on my first real estate investment in New York. Right. So now, oh, I'm a real estate genius, which I really wasn't. I just had some good tailwinds behind me, which was another thing I learned. But anyway, I bought this piece of land and was like, oh, I'll sell it in a couple of years and it'll, you know, be double value, or maybe I'll build on it one day. And then
did you make money on it?
When I eventually sold it, no. but I didn't lose money either. And I had a tremendous amount of things that I like I learned so much from it. It's kind of unbelievable. And it's what set me on this path that I'm on now.
That's awesome. And I
didn't lose money. I mean, I think if I sat down with like a forensic accountant and we went through everything, I think I did make money because of the tax benefits that I had for over 5 years. Plus I got to enjoy the house from time to time. So, right. You know, there was a lot of benefits in it besides just a dollar value. But if you look at like what I paid for it and then what I got at the end, you know, it's about a break even.
You know, that's important though. We talked about just a little bit ago about having to finally step out and take action and take a risk. And you did that by buying land and then, you know, wanting to build what was going to be a second home, but an investment home. For me, I bought a new construction duplex, and that was October of 2017. And when I signed the contract, it was going to take a year to build. I was glad that I did it, but I was like, this is just going to take forever to build any wealth, you know? So that's when I went looking to go bigger. And then we got involved in the same group and whatnot. But, you know, people ask me, are you, you know, bummed out that you did that duplex? And I'm like, yes and no. I'm like, I'm happy I did it because it got me into the real estate game. You know, like I had wanted to be in real estate and it, you know, like a lot of people, I was just hamstrung and just couldn't take action. And so I'm glad I did it because it got me in. But I for sure think that the syndication, the larger scale properties are a much better avenue for me to invest in going forward. But, you know, part of it's mindset too. You know, you have to, you know, some people can't go right there, you know? And for us, we both kind of dipped our toe in it, doing something different and then found our way. And like you, I'm glad that I did it because it forced me and it got me on the journey.
Yeah. Darren, if I can add on to that, yeah. I think there's sort of two mindset jumps that, tend to be difficult for most people, myself included. So, the first one is location. And the second one is size. So a lot of people are uncomfortable investing outside of their own backyard. Now I run a meetup group here in Massachusetts, and we've had this topic a couple of times now, and it's always very popular when we talk about investing out of state. And I have a panel of people who've invested out of state. And then I'll be the moderator and ask them all kinds of different questions. And then we open it up for people, but it always gets tremendous amount of turnout. And then the other thing, is size. And I talk with people all the time and they're like, well, I think I need to do a duplex or a four right. unit first. And I always say, hey, anything that you can do is great. And I encourage you to do a duplex or a four unit, but just realize you don't have to start there. You can start with a 100-unit right. property. Right. You know, you need to have somebody with experience kind of teaming up with you on that because it's your first time doing it. But you don't have to start small. And actually, the difference between doing a 2-unit and doing it 100-unit, there are some big differences there. You know, going from, as you know, 4 units or less is set up one type of way, especially with the financing, and then 5 units or more, it's set up in a different format. So, you know, those are, like you said, two mindset shifts that people need to, myself included, that I needed to get over to be able to get involved in the syndication game.
Yeah, that's huge. That's a great point. A great point. And you put that very well. Now, so talk about one of the larger deals that you did. I know you did a 100-plus-unit deal in Kansas, and you're living in Boston. Kind of talk about how that came about. How'd you decide Kansas as a market? And then, you know, from there, how'd you build a team and build credibility with the brokers locally in that market?
Yeah. So there is a popular podcast that probably some of your listeners listen to where one of the hosts is known for saying, live where you want to live and invest where the numbers make sense.
I don't know. Which one? Who is that?
Are you serious?
Yeah, absolutely. Oh,
it's the real estate guys.
Okay, very good.
Yeah, the real estate guys. Robert Helms is kind of, I think, known for saying that. He says that quite often. And, you know, the numbers didn't make sense for me at the time. I had already moved down to Miami and, you know, I was looking. I had gotten involved in that syndication group that you're talking about, the mentoring group. And I had been to actually one of the real estate guys conferences. That's how I found out about the mentor group that I joined that you're part of. And
we're both part of the Brad Sumrock group out of Dallas. So yep. That group is in Dallas. And so how did you pick Kansas?
So what happened was I started looking and I didn't start looking in Kansas City. I actually started looking in Ohio where my cousin lives, where I had done some flips. And I was also looking in Miami, and the numbers and the scale just weren't making sense in both locations. And so I was looking for a third location. And I mentioned earlier in our discussion today that I used to be an actor and that I had performed all over the country. And one of the places I had performed was Kansas City. I actually spent an entire summer in Kansas City in my 20s doing a couple of shows. And at the time, I was very naive and didn't think much of Kansas City before I went there. I thought I was going to have a very boring summer. And I was really blown away with the fact that the city was so metropolitan. And I had a blast, one of the best summers of my life. So I always had a soft spot in my heart for Kansas City. And I started looking at different markets. And also, one of my dearest friends, who was a roommate of mine actually in college, he moved to Kansas City with his wife, and daughter.
Is he still living there now?
Well, interestingly enough, no, now he lives outside of Nashville, but you know, going back 5 years ago, he was there.
Okay.
And, I started reaching out to some local brokers in that area. I had already done this now twice. I had done it in Ohio and I had done it in Florida. So I was pretty comfortable with it and, you know, had some experience doing this, trying, you know, figuring out how to find the brokers and reaching out to them and talking with them on the phone. And at that point, I had also invested in a number of syndications, so felt very comfortable with what I was doing and had a little bit of a resume and started to get to know the players in the area and started making trips out to Kansas City. Well, at first I started looking at deals. I had looked at the fundamentals of the market. It's a good market. It's not amazing. It's not Dallas, you know, but it's a solid market. And so I went out there and started to get to know the property managers and get to know the brokers. And it took me a couple of years of going out there and developing those relationships. But I ended up, you know, finally getting a deal out there after, you know, looking at literally hundreds of deals and putting out several offers. And then finally ended up with one. So it was great.
That's awesome. You said a lot of things there, you know, in the beginning, you know, when you were doing it in Miami and Ohio, like reaching out to the brokers and everything was new and you didn't have experience and you didn't have a resume and you probably didn't have the confidence level you had, but then you had built that up over time. And so when you started to go out to the Kansas City market, you know, you were confident that, hey, you were a guy that they need to pay attention to. And you felt confident that you could build that credibility.
Yeah. You know, I wasn't so scared anymore. I honestly, the first couple of times I sat down with a broker, I put on my best poker face and tried to act like I knew what I was doing, but I was really scared and I didn't know what I was doing. And maybe that showed. But eventually over time, I got comfortable with it.
Right. Matt, that is an awesome point. You know, people have asked me, you know, going through your first syndication, what was the scariest part? I was like, it was all scary, you know, until you do it, right? You know, the first time you call the broker, it's scary. The first time you go on the property tour, it's scary. The first time, you know, put an offer in, it's scary. But then you build confidence. And that sounds like that's what you did. And you said that it took you a couple of years to get your first deal.
That's right.
You know, some people, you know, they think that it just comes overnight success, but there's a lot of, you know, getting out there and building relationships that happens behind the scenes before, you know, the deals actually come.
I agree with that. It ties into kind of what you were saying earlier. I think you mentioned something about, you know, the actors and, you know, you hear all these overnight successes, but then when you peel back those layers, no, it was not an overnight success. They had been doing this for a very long time. And, you know, it's the same thing, I think, just anywhere and in life, you know, you work at things, you practice, you get better, you get more comfortable. I mean, sure, there are those anomalies. There are those people who decide they want to syndicate a deal, and the first deal they look at, they put in an LOI and they get it, right? But I think those are like a one in a million. I think normally for most people, it takes time.
Absolutely. So did you end up partnering with somebody who had experience on that 100 plus unit deal in Kansas City?
I sure did. Yeah. You know, I don't know if I could have done it without that partner. And I've enjoyed working with that partner. I've continued to work with him on a number of different deals.
Who did you work with? Who's your partner?
A guy named Justin Martinez.
Oh yeah. Justin. Yeah.
Yeah. Awesome. So, yeah, Justin's great. We have a wonderful working relationship together. And, you know, I there's a couple of different reasons why you're going to want to use a partner on something like this. You know, the first thing that comes to mind for me is the loan, right? Getting that loan. Now, I had been a KP on a deal, a 168 unit property. So I already had sort of my Fannie card, you know, as they say, sort of the credentials with Fannie.
What is a KP for people that don't know what that
sure.
is?
So KP is a key principal. So, you know, pretty much the gold standard on loans for these multifamily, the ones that a lot of people like to do are agency loans. So those are loans that are going to be backed by either Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac. And in order to get an agency loan, you have to, I've already done an agency loan. Now that I think there are ways around that. I'm not a mortgage guy. I'm not a mortgage broker. So you could talk with one about that in more detail. But basically, if you already have done a Fannie or Freddie loan, you can pretty much get another one of the same size. If you've never done one before, like me going after a $10 million acquisition. I never would have, I think, qualified for that loan if I had done it on my own without having been a KP. Now I had been a KP on another deal, 168 units. So now I sort of like had a, you know, I was sort of in the some people say it's like getting your Fannie card. It's like getting a card to like a country club or whatever, you know, like you sort of have, you know, you're in the group, if you will.
You're a known entity within their database. They can look at you. You're part of another deal that's performing well. And so it lowers the risk for them doing business on another
Thank
deal
you.
With you.
Yeah. Yes. You've explained that much better than I did. That's 100% correct. So maybe I would have qualified for the loan, but having Justin on my team as a co-sponsor with me, we were able to leverage his resume, right? And his experience where he has, you know, at the time, I think he had somewhere between 8 to 10 deals done at that time that were performing well, right? So Fannie could actually look at it and be like, okay, well, this Justin guy is doing it and look how all of his deals are performing.
Right.
So it sort of bolstered that. Getting back to the key principle. So a key principle is someone who can sign on a deal, which I did. Now I was not a sponsor on that deal. And it was a non-recourse Fannie Mae loan. So as a key principal, I am, donating, utilizing my net worth and my liquidity to go with the sponsorships team net worth and liquidity to help them qualify for the loan. And I'm signing on those documents. Now it's a non-recourse loan. So if the deal doesn't perform because of just natural circumstances, let's say, they can't come after me and like take my home. But there are specific clauses that they call, I think it's a slang term, they call it, you know, bad boy carve outs. There are some clauses in these documents that actually, they're the clauses in these contracts that state that if the deal goes south for, you know, just let's say natural causes, you know, nothing wrong, just the business plan didn't work, the lender cannot come after you personally. They can foreclose on that property, but they can't come after you and take like your home or your car or things of that nature. But those carve outs, those bad boy carve outs state that if something's done in a fraudulent manner, like you lied on your application or you're embezzling money or something of that nature, then they can come after you personally.
Right.
So as a key principle, as long as you feel comfortable with that sponsorship team and that they're not going to do things of, you know, that are illegal and fraudulent, you can sign on these deals and again, let them sort of leverage your balance sheet to qualify for the loan and you sign on the document. So then you're a signer on the document. That's called a key principle. And that allows you to sort of be, you know, help you for qualifications for further loans that you may be seeking. Right.
So, you know, here's a question. You've got your partner and you mentioned that he already had 8 to 10 deals. Why would he ever want to partner with you? Not that you're not a nice guy.
I was going to say, I'm a really great guy.
You are a great guy, but you're a newbie, right? You haven't done a large syndication. So, you know, the reason why I asked this question is because I've talked to a lot of people that have that mindset that they're not worthy to partner with another experienced guy. Why would they want to partner with a newbie? So help explain why somebody like Justin, who had 8 to 10 deals, you know, decided to say yes.
Well, Justin and I got to know each other over time. And I think that was a key factor in the decision making. I mean, there's the other aspect, which is, hey, why wouldn't he want another deal, right? He's going to derive income from that if the deal is successful, right? But I think more than that, Justin really wanted to work with me, and I really wanted to work with him. He was a coach in that program that we're in, so I had gotten to know him, and we had looked at deals together a number of times, and we were very much of the same mindset and went about analyzing deals in the same way. You know, I've had people who've asked me to partner with them on deals, and I enjoy partnering with people on deals, but I've had people who've asked me who I don't feel comfortable with the underwriting. They didn't necessarily, you know, those people in particular were not in this sort of mentorship group that you and I are in. And I just didn't feel comfortable. I felt like their underwriting was a bit aggressive and I liked them as people, but I just didn't feel comfortable bringing a deal like that, you know, putting my name on that deal because I felt like it was a little just aggressive. So
right.
I think Justin and I both have been approaching things the same way. I think he liked working with me. I think I brought value to the partnership, as did he, and that we complemented each other very well. So as an experienced sponsor, you know, look, I'm pretty experienced now myself. If I meet somebody and we look at things the same way and we agree on, an approach on a property, I would love to co-sponsor with people. I like working with teams. There are advantages to not being an island onto yourself. I think multifamily is a team sport. There's many different people who can bring different skills to the table. And, you know, for all of those reasons, it sort of makes sense. And then there's also the point of where I think Justin just enjoys helping people too. You know, I think
that's huge.
I mean, he makes money off of the deal too, but I think he's genuinely, he's like, he has been able to get to a point where he is, pretty much self-sufficient, just doing, you know, the real estate stuff. And he's enjoyed it. And he wants to be able to help other people who are looking to do that, who are hard. I mean, again, I got to know Justin over about a year and a half to 2 years. So he knew who I was. He knew what my work ethic was. You know what I mean? Yep. And so I think he felt like it would be a great partnership.
So a few things there. One is relationship. I mean, you know, if you want a partner, it doesn't matter if you're dealing with another experienced guy or somebody on your level, you know, you want to work with people that you like, you know, you trust. And so you have to build those relationships. You know, secondly, you know, you didn't mention this, but I'm guessing that Justin wasn't even looking in Kansas City, right? He was not, maybe I'm wrong, but he probably was not focused on that market. And so you did all the legwork in building the relationships with the brokers, the property management companies, et cetera, and breaking into that market, finding the deal, underwriting the deal. And then you go to the experienced guy and he reviews it, discusses it with you. He gets excited. And now he's part of the deal. You've done all the legwork. That's the value that you brought. And then he brings the resume and the experience.
Exactly. When people who are first looking at getting involved in syndication as a sponsor ask me about this, I basically tell them there's sort of three things that you can that you need to bring to a deal. One of three things, which is either the money, right? I mean, if you have $2 million, you need to raise $2 million of equity in a deal, and you have $2 million, you're like, I'm going to fund this entire deal. Great, you know, like you're good. So, you know, if you're independently wealthy, that's one way to break in. Another way would be to have the experience, right? And then the third way is to find the deal. And so that's exactly what I did. I found the deal. And I, you know, in terms of the capital raising, I was able to raise, you know, a good amount of capital, and I put my own money in the deal and all of that stuff too. But it was really about finding the deal. I was like the finding the deal guy, and Justin was like the experienced guy. And then together we worked together on raising that capital.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Hey, I'm also going to go back to, you know, we talked to a little bit about the KP thing. In the space that we're in, you know, I've kind of heard it over and over again. You know, you can buy your own deal, you could be KP, and then you can, you know, syndicate a deal that you, or you could be a passive investor in a deal, then you could become a KP, and then you can become a syndicator. And having gone down that path, I did the same thing as you. I did, you know, seven passive deals, and I one deal I did as a KP, and then I syndicated a deal. But after the fact, I look back on it and I'm like, you know what? If you're going to partner with somebody who has massive experience anyway, that guy or girl has the Fannie or Freddie card, right? Yep. So I would say to people that, you know, don't have the abundance of capital, you don't have to become a KP before syndicating. You just have to partner with somebody that has already, you know, has a lot of experience with Fannie and Freddie, and they, because they have the experience, you collectively as the general partnership group will be fine.
Yeah, I think that's right.
So I'm going to switch gears a little bit. You mentioned you're an actor. You also mentioned, you know, I don't, you didn't mention it yet on this call, but I know that your wife has produced a Broadway show and you helped with that. You know, it makes a little more sense now to me that knowing that you actually went to school for, you know, for acting, and you were an actor for 5 years. And I was always curious as to how you got involved with that. But explain, you know, the Broadway show that your wife is involved with, and, you know, what your role is in with that. And, you know, now that we're in the middle of COVID, how COVID has impacted that business.
Sure. So I met my wife years after I had been involved in theater. So I was still, you know, look, I'm a huge fan of theater and music. I'm like a big fan of music. I love going to see shows and live concert, more like, you know, rock type stuff. And So that's always been interesting to me. When I first met my wife, Erica, I found that it was very interesting that she was, you know, involved in the theater full time. And I think she found that interesting that I had that background, but wasn't involved in it anymore. So I understood, you know, we kind of had that same language. I understood what was going on and things. And we ended up knowing, interestingly enough, we ended up knowing a lot of the same people. And we ended up actually having been, we both worked at the same place at the same time, but had never met. Now, she is 8 years younger than me. So at the time, she was in high school and I was, you know, just freshly out of college. So it's probably good that we didn't meet back right. then. Right. But she was interning at the same place where I was doing a show. She had actually seen the show, but we never met each other. It was just kind of a funny thing. So Erica is involved in the management side of theater, right? So she initially wanted to be a performer. When she went to college, she realized that maybe performing wasn't her thing and that she was really good at the business aspects of it. So she has had a career doing that, mainly on Broadway, and worked on a lot of, you know, all the big, most of the big Broadway shows. I mean, she's worked on a lot of them and has a lot of experience working in different roles. She did marketing. She did, you know, company management, which is kind of like the property manager, if you will, on a real estate deal. She did that kind of general management, company management kind of stuff. And Erica and I got married and we started, she had already produced a show an off-Broadway show that she fell in love with, and she helped bring that to Broadway, and it was nominated for Tony.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah, unfortunately it didn't win, but it was a great, great, great show. And she had done some other stuff off-Broadway and whatnot, and so she had opportunities to get involved in Broadway shows. Now, they're very, very risky from a financial perspective, but if you get a show like a Phantom of the Opera, you know, that runs for years and years and years, it can be very lucrative as well.
Right.
But most shows lose money. So she was very selective about the show she got involved in. I started getting involved in shows with her and we started investing in shows, and not large amounts of money, but not small either, you know. And we started investing and, you know, we had shows that didn't do well, you know, that we thought would make sense. And again, it was not something that we did every year. Maybe we'd do it every other year. You know, it depended on the project, right? And who was involved in the project.
How are these shows funded? Is it similar to a syndication? You said that you invested. It is?
It is. Okay. It's basically like a 506C. Is how they're usually set up, right? So it's, you need to be an accredited investor.
Gotcha.
They don't really advertise for them, but right. And they raise capital for them. And I mean, it's got the same PPM and subscription document. It's,
wow.
It's, yeah, yeah. Which was really interesting because when I started getting involved in the syndication world on the real estate side, I'm like, oh, this is just like the Broadway show stuff.
Right.
I had already done the Broadway stuff a little bit. So, you know, we were fortunate where we invested in one particular show that was a, you know, massive, massive hit. So we invested in that one as well as some others. And then, you know, most recently, Erica and I both got involved. I had been involved with her on some of the other ones too. There was another one that we got involved in on the GP side, but we got involved in Moulin Rouge, both Erica and I, and we're both billed as co-producers on that show, and so we've been involved in that. We were also involved in David Byrne's American Utopia. We also have co-producer credits on that. That was on Broadway. That was a huge success. That was a limited run, and David Byrne was the lead singer for Talking Heads. It was an awesome show. It was really great. It was pretty risky, we thought, but we really liked it, and it ended up being the returns on it were fantastic, and it's actually was going to be going back to Broadway this fall, but because of COVID, it's not. And so Moulin Rouge was doing really well. You know, we had hopes that it would get nominated maybe for some Tony Awards. Financially, it was right on track with where we thought it would be. And then, you know, March came and the COVID thing came. Now, the Burn show had already closed, so it was fine. And it will reopen at another date and time to be determined. Right. So that's fine. The Moulin Rouge one was a little problematic because it was still running, so they had to stop it. You know, and so all of Broadway stopped in March, and they have canceled all the shows at the time that we're recording this podcast through the end of the year. There is thoughts that it will hopefully open up, you know, in the spring, maybe in March or April, but nobody really knows. We have to see how this COVID thing goes. A lot of the Broadway shows right now have some sort of business interruption insurance, which is hopefully, you know, making them be okay. And some of them are going to close and not be able to reopen.
Right.
You know, I don't have insight into the financials of the ones that I'm not involved in, but, you know, hopefully they have some sort of business interruption insurance, and hopefully it's enough to sort of carry them through. Right now, while the shows are not happening, the costs are very low because there's no, you know, salaries and things that need to get paid for the actors and all the different people involved. But there is rent, right? So the way that most of these are set up, there's a base rent, and then the theater owners, because that's different than the producers. Once in a while, you'll have a theater owner who is also a producer, but most of the time, the theater owner is separate, and so they'll take a percentage of the box office as part of their rent, but they have a minimum rent. So right now, a lot of the shows are paying a minimum rent, or the producers are negotiating that with the different theater owners on a, you know, one by one basis. But
right.
There are costs that are being incurred, but they're not at the scale of when the show's actually running. So Moulin Rouge did very well at the beginning. It was very popular, and the ticket sales were really good. And our property management, it's the general manager, but just like property management in real estate, was very wise in terms of keeping good reserves and things like that. So hopefully we'll be able to, you know, depending on how long this thing goes, you know, the intention is certainly that we'll start the show back up, and it'll almost be as if there was just a really long pause. Unfortunately, a lot of the new shows that we're just starting are not going to be able to come back. And it's a real shame.
It is a shame. And you know, a few things there. One, you know, it's obvious that you're passionate about theater, about, you know, acting, about these shows, and you also have a passion towards real estate. And it's also interesting on how these deals are funded, you know, how these shows come about are through a syndication similar to what you're doing on the real estate side. And so you have two completely different industries, but you know, part of the funding process, you know, is very similar.
Yeah.
The other thing is, you know, I was listening to another podcast, and you know, I drive by the you know, just movie theaters, and we all know we drive by the movie theaters and they're all closed, right?
Yeah.
And it's a shame. But I was listening to a podcast, and the producer was like, "Look, we've spent 4 years putting this film together, and it was supposed to come out this summer, and now we're having to push it another year." Like those types of impact, you know, that COVID is having, you know, I just don't think about all those, you know, different businesses that are impacted in that way. It's really a shame, but
yeah, you know, to jump on that, my wife, she runs, her 9 to 5, or it's really not 9 to 5. She works a lot of evening hours because it's the theater, but her job here in Boston, she runs the Emerson Colonial Theater, which is a big theater in downtown. And they have a lot of shows before Broadway will go here first, and then they go to Broadway. So she was involved actually in both Moulin Rouge and David Byrne's American Utopia were both here before they went to Broadway. And she gets to be very involved in them. And there's a new show, a new Broadway show that was supposed to be coming here. And it's going to be cool whenever it comes. I can't, you know, talk much about it, but it's a really cool idea. And they ended up having to cancel it being even here because they need to do workshops and rehearse and write, you know, finish writing it and all of that kind of stuff that they're unable to do right now. So that thing's on pause. And so I wonder what Broadway is going to look like for the next, you know, couple of years. And the same thing with movies and just entertainment in general, because there's been a pause in the development of things.
Right.
So it's like you're saying with the movies, it's like the stuff that's already in the can, as they say, can be released later, but there's no new stuff being shot right now. At least right. I don't think a lot.
So why do I even ask you about all this? This is a real estate show. For me, the reason why I want to talk about Matt a little bit, what is passionate for Matt is that, you know, if people, you know, want to invest with you, I believe they want to know the person, right?
And 100%.
It's not just about the deal. It's about who you're doing business with. If you passively invest in a deal, you know, you're most likely going to be in that deal for 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 years, you know, what the typically a 5-year business plan, maybe you get out in 3 years, maybe it's 6 or 7, but you know, I think understanding, you know, a little bit more about the sponsor and about, you know, the person that's leading the charge is important, and it's important to me. So I want to bring that out to listeners. So with that, help us understand, you know, where did you find most of the passive investors that have invested in your deals? Are they friends and colleagues from prior businesses? Are they people, you mentioned that you have a meetup group in Boston. Are they from the meetup group in Boston? Are they from the multifamily mentorship group that we're both part of in here in Dallas? Where did most of the investors come from?
Yeah, that's a really good question, Darren. And just to piggyback on that, you know, I agree with you. And I have a lot of people who are in my meetup group here, you know, who will come to me and go, what do you think about this deal? You know, can I get your advice? Do you think this is a good deal? You know, someone else's deal that they're syndicating. And the first question I ask them is like, how do you know this person? Because sometimes right. they're like, oh, I just met them on Facebook last week. And I'm like, okay, well, don't invest in that deal. Like, you don't know this person. Like, I think that you need to know the person. The most important thing is, I think, the person who's running the deal. I've invested in deals that have gone south. And the ones that have had really good sponsors have been able to do okay, you know, and get themselves out of it. And I haven't lost money. But I've had other deals that should have been great and had bad sponsorship. And, you know, they got mediocre results just because we've had such a good economy behind us for the past, you know, 5-10 years. Right. So that sponsor is really important. Now, the way that I've gotten investors, the way it started for me was with my friends and family circle. You know, having lived in New York City for 25 years and having worked, you know, climbing that corporate ladder in digital marketing, and just being a social guy, you know, I've met a number of people, and I put them all in my database when I moved to Miami and sent them all an email and said, hey, I'm going to start sending you, you know, updates on my real estate stuff. And, you know,
so you let them know before you had a deal, you kind of prepped them. Hey, yeah. I'm shifting focus to real estate.
Yeah.
And I'm going to keep you guys, you know, updated.
Yeah. Yeah, and a whole ton of them like unsubscribed right away, which was fine, you know. Like, no thanks, Matt, which is fine. Again, right. You know, you got to have a tough skin for this. The one thing that I can say I took from the acting business was, you know, I was a working actor. I did pretty well, but the only reason why was because I went on like a gazillion auditions, and I would just go out on audition after audition and get rejected and rejected and rejected, and I don't care, like. It got to a point where I was like, all right, fine. Like, you know, they don't want me on to the next one. Right. So, you know, that was kind of how I felt like this. You know, if they're not interested, that's fine. You know, it's totally fine. This is kind of random and I'm reaching out to them. So my first deal that I did was syndicated all on my end. I would say like 90% of it was friends and family, you know, people that I knew, people that I had done a deal with in the past, had worked with in the past at an agency or something like that. About 10% was from that mentorship group. Now, Justin, you know, was involved in it as well. And he had people from the mentorship group and he had his own database and stuff like that. But
From your side. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and then as things have evolved, I've gotten to know more people. So, now I have people from the local Massachusetts area that I've gotten to know over time. And, you know, usually they don't invest in the first deal or two that they say, hey, I want to start seeing your deals.
Right.
They don't invest right away. They get to know me over time. They can see my deals over time and then they feel comfortable. And then now there's people that have heard me, you know, like maybe someone will hear me on your podcast. I've had people hear me on other podcasts and reach out to me. And then I've gotten to know them and then I'll put them on my investor database because I do 506B. So I have to have a pre-existing relationship with somebody and get to know them and understand kind of what they're about and what their experience is before I can invite them to be part of any deals that I might be doing.
That completely makes sense. So with what I found, you tell me if you agree or disagree, but what I found is the friends and family side of things, you know, there's a little bit more education that, you know, talking to the, hey, it's like, hey, Darren, I like you. I like your deal, but I don't know anything. I don't really understand this thing. You know, can you help me understand it?
Yep.
The people that are already in, you know, I've invested in multifamily before. It's like, hey, I like you. I like your deal, but I've got five other deals in my inbox. You know, which one, why yours over the others? You know, it's not, there's less time spent on, you know, real estate as, you know, versus the stock market. And there's less time. How does this multifamily thing work? It's more this deal versus that deal. Would you agree with that?
I would agree with that.
Okay. So to get to where you are today, you know, you've had to sacrifice some things. Talk about some of the sacrifices you've made along the way, you know, both, you know, chasing your dream as an actor, you know, climbing the corporate ladder and, you know, getting into real estate. There's certain sacrifices that you have to make to achieve certain goals.
That's a good question, Darren. No one's ever asked me that before. So I'm trying to wrap my head around it as I'm speaking. You know, what I will say is that I don't know.
Think about time. Think about money.
Yeah.
Think about relationships.
So a lot of those things have not been sacrifices, right? So, but what I will say has been, wasn't the, so couple of things. So, in terms of my, previous careers, there were sacrifices that came with being able to, climb that corporate ladder and things like that. What I will say is that moving into the stuff that I do right now has allowed me to actually have less sacrifices. And the only thing I've had to sacrifice is that sort of like false sense of stability. Okay. So before, when I had the 9-to-5 job, I had, this is my salary and this is how much I get paid and this is what's happening. Now, the stability around that is really very false. Right now, when I have a lot of friends that are still in that business, and COVID has now come, a lot of people are not spending money on marketing right now.
Right.
So a lot of them have lost jobs. And also, even before the COVID thing, you know, which is kind of a once-off, hopefully once-off black swan event, I was working at a company several years ago. I was brought on and built to create their digital department. I created it. We won this big award from one of the trade publications. We were named Comeback Agency of the Year. We were doing awesome. And we were owned by a by a parent company. There was a holding company that owned us. And in their infinite wisdom, they felt that they wanted to merge us with another company that they owned in New York because it would save them money in terms of like overhead, right? So they did that. And in that, I was first given a retention bonus if I would stay. And then once the dust cleared and the power struggle was done and we saw who was in charge at the new agency that was formed by combining these two agencies, I was out of a job. Because there was two people that, you know, they had a head of digital. I was a head of digital. You know, the other head of digital was great. And she just knew them better because I've been working with them for years. And so I lost my job, even though I've been doing a great job. So, for me, there was a sacrifice on having that sort of known quantity and sort of jumping into this unknown. But luckily, I had been investing in the Broadway shows and also in other real estate stuff enough where I had passive income coming in. Which allowed me to sort of make that leap. But the work that I do now, I still work hard. I still work long hours. I do have to sacrifice a little bit in terms of like, I have to get on a plane now and then to go to properties and do property tours and things like that. But I'm able to sort of time shift the work that I do. I can work early in the morning. I can work at night, but you know, I can change that around. So I'm available to spend time with, I have two very young children. So I'm able to spend time
with
them.
You can move your office to the outdoors.
I can move my office to the outdoors. I have the two of them are running around dressed like little princesses running around our house right now. And my wife is a saint and taking care of them, but we're able to, sort of time shift. So during this whole COVID thing, I'm, you know, Mr. Mom for half of the day so that my wife can do her work for half of the day. And then we switch. And then usually at night, both of us are finishing up all the other stuff that we weren't able to get to because we only had half of a day. But, you know, even before this, you know, I was able to, you know, once in a while, the older one, I took her out of school, a preschool one day just for fun. And we went to this place. Just before last summer, that this like place that's like ice cream and games and all kinds of stuff, and you know, do good fun family bonding stuff that I'm able to do now. That had I been working, if we still lived in New York and I was still working in a corporate digital advertising agency, I mean, I worked crazy long hours. If we had a business pitch, you know, I wouldn't be home for like, you know, a week or two while we're working on that. Lots of late nights and things like that. So, shifting into this was a little bit of sacrifice financially also at first a little bit, but I had the passive income. I've now been doing this for almost 5 years, about 5 years now. So I've built up that passive income and you know, it's been good.
That's awesome. Awesome. Yeah. Sometimes, you know, something that seems like a bad thing, like you lost your job, right? It could be scary and just seem like the world's caving in on you, actually could turn out for the good, right?
Yeah, I ended up getting a much better job after that. So you know, it all worked out.
So Matt, you've done a ton and you've accomplished a ton. What's your stretch goal? What's next for you?
You know, I have some, you know, financial metrics that I'm working to hit on the passive income side. And then on sort of that active side, you know, I'm continuing to look at deals. You know, I don't have a certain door number or certain number of properties or property, you know, I'm just looking for good opportunities to get involved with, you know.
That makes sense. The other thing is before we started talking,
yeah,
you know, you mentioned that you're writing a book. You also talked about you've got this, you know, meetup group that you started in the Massachusetts area. And, you know, this was a conversation before we hit record and started this thing, but it's obvious to me that you're a guy that wants to give back and teach others and help others. And so when I ask you about the stretch goal, you know, some people do have that, you know, I want to be at a certain number of doors or a certain number of assets under management. But you know, it sounds to me like, yeah, you want to continue to progress financially, but you also are focused on trying to help others.
Yeah, I mean, I am. I'm, you know, beyond the, you know, the things that you mentioned and helping others in real estate, you know, one of the things that I'm a big proponent is I'm on this, you know, young leaders committee or something like this for a charity local here that's helping solve homelessness crisis here in Boston, which is, it's completely all about giving back. And so, you know, I've been involved in that and helping them sort of raise funds and get the word out about the great work that they're doing. So, yeah, I mean, I've always been someone who tries to help, you know, my whole sort of mission with the real estate that I do is just trying to help like improve the lives of people, both the residents of the apartments that we own and also the investors. Right. So it's all about trying to create improvement and trying to, you know, leave the world a little bit of a better place than when I first got here. You know, the book that I'm writing is, you know, the goal to have it ready by the end of the year. And it's about sort of my journey.
The end of this year?
The end of this year.
Awesome.
That's the goal.
Awesome.
We'll see. I've never written a book before. And so it is quite an exercise and quite an undertaking. But it's been really good. And so I've been working on that a lot. And I'm hoping that information through telling my story and actually having really good lessons in there that I learned, that I can pass those on to people who are looking to passively invest in deals, or maybe people who are looking to actively invest. I think a lot of people who are looking to actively invest may know already some of those lessons, but I'm hoping that I'm presenting it in an entertaining way and an insightful manner. And that's what I try to do with the meetup. You know, the meetup, I always have great guests come in and talk. Once in a while, I'll get up on stage and share information. And it's really about getting people together and getting people to know one another. And the biggest thrill I get, I started doing this thing at the beginning of them now, is I do a shout out at the beginning, because I'm like, oh, this one just did a deal. You know, before it wasn't like that. And now, you know, we're consistently getting like over 100 people. Sometimes we'll have over 200 people.
Wow. Wow. That's a great size meetup.
Oh yeah. It's fantastic. And, you know, we've got this whole floor of a restaurant and bar, and we've got the whole bar and there's a stage and a microphone. I mean, it took us a while to find a great venue, but I finally found one, and we've been there for a while now, and it's taken time to grow the mass that we have, but we get people together, and now I'm like, oh, this one just did a deal, and this one just partnered together on a deal. And the whole point of it was, you know, it's not, we're not selling any sort of like mentorship kind of thing, which a lot of these are. It's really about people who are interested in real estate getting together, sharing ideas, and partnering together to do deals. And it gives me nothing gives me greater joy besides my family than seeing people that I've met that have gotten together and done a deal together and that are being successful together. That really lights me up.
That's
and
awesome.
So, yeah.
What's the name of the meetup group if people are listening from your area?
Well, it's best to just reach out to me directly and I can get you on the mailing list, because it's a mouthful, but it's the Multifamily Investors Network of Massachusetts.
That is a lot. It is a lot. So with that said, if people want to reach out to you, Matt, how do they get in touch with you?
Yeah. So it's a lot shorter. It's just mjppg.com. So that's my website. And you can also just email me directly. It's just Matt, M-A-T-T at mjppg.com. I love talking with people about real estate, whether you own zero doors or a million. So feel free to reach out.
That's fantastic. Matt, I really appreciate you coming on the show. Listeners, I hope you enjoyed that one. Look, you can start from anywhere in any industry, and this guy just showed it. All right. So until next week, signing off.
Thank you for listening to Darren Batchelder's Real Estate Investing Show at darrenbatchelder.com. If you liked the episode, please provide us with a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or your podcast platform of choice. If you already provided us with a 5-star review, then thank you, and please share the show with a friend.